Ecclesiastes 5, 8 to 20. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil. This is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. At what point do people agree that they are living under tyranny? How many incremental acts of oppression must be imposed before they exclaim, "Behold the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness"? Note with me, just talking with some of the men about this the other day, our presidents recently claimed the power to detain prisoners in jail even after they've been acquitted of their crimes, all under the guise of the Homeland Security Act. I was all for this at first, after 9/11. Yeah, sure, pass that Homeland Security Act. But now, I'm sweating a little. Well, our presidents have also rammed a $2 trillion healthcare bill down the throats of an unwilling people and then defied a court order to restrict its implementation. When do we say the oppression of the poor, the violation of justice and righteousness? They have ignored court orders requiring the lifting on a moratorium on offshore drilling, required that companies competing for government contracts to disclose their political contributions. Can you imagine what that will entail in the granting of contracts? And in violation of the Fourth Amendment, various administrations have authorized the search and seizure of citizens at airports through TSA's warrantless groping of passengers. Some of us won't even fly anymore. I don't blame anyone for that. Our present administration refused to exercise his executive mandate to defend the Defense of Marriage Act, as well passed by Congress. He's an executor, an executive, executing the laws of the nation, supposedly. Our present attorney general has chosen not to defend the voting rights of whites by refusing to prosecute the new Black Panther Party when they intimidated white voters back in 2008. You recall this. Various presidents as well have refused to defend our borders in the South on the one hand and yet sue Arizona when they try to pass legislation to remedy this problem, claiming that the defense of the border is a federal power, which they don't exercise. And when the present administration could not persuade Congress to pass cap-and-trade legislation declaring carbon to be a toxic pollutant, which it manifestly is not, parenthetically. It simply had the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, declare carbon to be a toxic pollutant and then regulate it. On and on we could go. If our presidents had come to us in red cape with a pointy tail, horns on their heads, and cloven hooves instead of feet, we might have said, wait a minute. These are not friends of humanity. Instead, Plato's maxim still holds true. That is, this and no other is the root from which tyrant springs, Plato says. When he first appears, he is a protector. A protector. If all of the subtractions of our liberties and the additions of oppressive measures had been dropped on us all at once, in one generation of Americans maybe, that generation would have rebelled and thrown off that tyranny. Instead, progressive administrations have adopted the motto of one gradualist society, the Fabian Society. The inevitability of gradualism is their motto. The inevitability of gradualism. That is, not by any sudden or revolutionary act would you impose tyranny, but by gradual incremental steps, the old frog in the kettle parable. If the last several generations had not been deliberately schooled in ignorance of the Constitution as well, deliberately schooled in ignorance of the Constitution, and hailed the virtues of Marxist socialism, we would have been able to spot and stop in its tracks the erosion of our constitutional liberties. Instead, the motto of George Orwell's 1984, in 2008 I reread all of the tyranny novels, 1984 being one of them. George Orwell's, one of his mottos is, ignorance is strength. Ignorance is strength. And of course, the question that Orwell left open is, whose strength? The ruled or the ruler? Instead of a free constitutional republic, most Americans now wander around in a province of oppression, as our text puts it, where justice and righteousness are regularly violated. Most of us do this without even knowing that we do so, that we trip lightly through this land of oppression. And one has to wonder whether those spoken of here in our text today by Solomon knew that they too were oppressed by the king which Samuel had promised. These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons. He will take your daughters. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards. He will take the tenth of your grain and of your vineyards. He will take your male and your female servants. He will take the tenth of your flocks, and you will be his slaves. Most Americans ignorantly take pride in not being slaves while not taking stock. We take pride what we do not take stock, that they are in fact slaves. One of the factors that we have neglected thus far is one which our text does bring forth. That is, the motive and desire of a tyrant. Biblically informed people should not be slaves, because the text, at so many junctures, inculcates liberty and freedom and how to spot tyranny as well. Verses 5 through 9, for example. Dissatisfaction, that's our title of the message this day, dissatisfaction. So much sin is generated by dissatisfaction, is it not? Provides an opportunity for tyranny as well. Dissatisfaction. A magistrate not satisfied with his biblical measure of power will turn to oppression and tyranny, verses 5 through 9. This is an election year. We need to hear some things refreshed again. You may remember that we dealt in the precincts of the temple in our last sermon, last week. High and lifted up. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Here, in the remaining chapter of Ecclesiastes, here in chapter 5, we find ourselves in the opposite direction, in a contrasting place. We find ourselves in the outer precincts of Solomon's own government. If you see in a province, he says, What we encounter here is of a different order than what we would find in the temple, God's own dwelling place. There we would expect to find justice and righteousness and liberty, but not here. There is intended to be a glaring, distinctive contrast. Here we find the real politik of Henry Kissinger, if you will. Two things: the systematic oppression of the poor. The systematic oppression of the poor. The history of the world finds that the strong tyrannize over the weak to their advantage forever. Find me a culture and society where that has not been the case, mostly, right, through history. From the age of the pharaohs to King George III. Then, during a brief window of time in the age of the American Republic, all men have equal opportunity, at least, to thrive and prosper, and we've been trying to make that promise good. But now, owing to the factors mentioned above, we are now entering again into a dark night of the soul, if you will, when we will see again the systematic oppression of the poor, as outlined here by Koheleth. It will follow inevitably. Secondly, note as well the trampling of justice and righteousness. The systematic oppression of the poor, the trampling of justice and righteousness. In conjunction with the oppression of the poor, the history of our race has been dictated by the maxim, might makes right, not God's right shapes the wise exercise of man's right, might. Justice and righteousness, as understood here in this context, justice, the equitable distribution of reward for good behavior and punishment for bad behavior, and righteousness in this context, that is the promotion of the well-being and peace of one's fellow man, is being transgressed by the magistrate in question. Now in Israel, while under David, there may have been a few brief years when the tribes of Israel dwelt in peace, safety, and liberty, with perhaps a measure of this circumstance extending into Solomon's reign. We know that an incipient tyranny was already creeping into Israel by Solomon's day, was there not? Remember what Rehoboam said to the people. He said, "Whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke," that is under Solomon, "I will add to your yoke." Rehoboam also said, "My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions." So already under Solomon, there was an incipient tyranny, if not full-blown. Tyranny is a... I love the Greek tyrant Solon said, "Tyranny is a lofty perch, but there's no way down from it." That sounds like the voice of experience, doesn't it? Once entered upon, there's no turning back. Israel would progressively become more and more a place of tyranny, as do all peoples who neglect God, parenthetically. Not parenthetically. I would underline that, actually. Each subsequent generation of Israelites would progressively sink further and further into slavery until finally world tyrants on the order of Assyria for Israel and Babylon for Judah would come and put finally, the rings in their noses and the fish hooks in their lips. Remember the graphic illustration of their being dragged off to slavery in these respective lands. But it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way. Solomon concludes this reflection on systematic oppression. And he's talking here about systematic oppression. And you see built in the bureaucracy that's implicit in the officials, one by one, set higher than the last. The Frenchman Charles Péguy, I think that's how you pronounce his name, Charles Péguy, says tyranny is always better organized than freedom. That sounds like the voice of experience too, doesn't it? Tyranny is always better organized than freedom. Solomon concludes this reflection on systematic oppression with a proverb on better days. He says, "But this is gain in every way." That's a strong adversative in the Hebrew. "But," that is in contrast to tyranny, "this is gain in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields." This is gain. I like the King James rendering of this. This is gain for all. I think I like that better. I'm not completely sure yet, but I like the idea that this is gain for all. A king committed to cultivated fields. Now, what does that mean? Contrast the fields of men who are free, who own the land which they cultivate, and stand perhaps at risk, perhaps, of losing everything if they fail, if their crops fail, or they stand to gain great profit if they succeed. Wouldn't that be a motivator? Contrast these fields with those of socialist slaves who work the fields on behalf of the collective. We have a living illustration now in North Korea and South Korea, right? South Korea exports food. North Korea is in a perpetual state of starvation, aren't they? Those of us old enough to remember, this was the situation in the contrast between the United States of America and the Soviet Union, or Red China for that matter. And it was true in the days of Solomon. A king committed to cultivated fields is a metaphor for the cultivation, if you will, of the liberty and well-being of the people. And this is not an easy thing to achieve, is it? It is a thing that must be fought for by both king and people, the Lord and his subjects. Scottish proverb says, "He who allows the oppression shares the crime." I like that. He who allows the oppression shares the crime. Both must fight for liberty. Even as the Israelites found it much easier to lay down the burden of liberty, there is a burden to liberty, is there not? There is a responsibility to liberty, true, genuine liberty. And even as the Israelites found it much easier to lay down the burden of liberty along with that liberty when they asked for a king, so it seems true of every man that there is the temptation, is there not, to surrender the risk of failure or success for the security of entrusting it to another. Those wise bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., who know so much better than us. But be it not so with us. Resistance is not futile. The Borg can be beaten. I love Thomas Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard. If you ever get a chance to, it's old but sweet. It mellows with age. Thomas Gray says, "Some village shire that with dauntless breast the little tyrant of his fields withstood." He's talking, now he's moving among the gravestones and speculating on the lives contained therein and in the gravestones. And he says, "Some village shire that with dauntless breast the little tyrant of his fields withstood. Some mute and glorious Milton here may rest. Some Cromwell, guiltless of his country's blood." He's imagining all these who have resisted tyranny in the past in England. Gone nameless, perhaps. Milton, he was very active with Cromwell in the English Revolution. Resistance is not futile. The Borg can be beaten. But liberty and tyranny is not the only theme that's brought out here, is it? If you know me, you know I could probably wax elephants on this for most of the day. But that's not all the text is communicating to us. Verses 10 through 12, for example. Dissatisfaction. A rich man not satisfied with his biblical measure of wealth will turn to greed and vexation of soul as well. He will turn to greed and vexation of soul. Koheleth here reflects upon the fleeting nature of riches, especially by those with a nagging... Don't let that go by too quickly. The idea of the fleetingness, the vaporousness of riches, that's been our translation, rather than vanity, vanity, or meaninglessness, meaninglessness. This is communicating the brevity, the vaporousness of life and the various things under consideration. Here it is riches. The fleeting nature of riches. especially by those with a nagging, vexed spirit that constantly yearns for more. Notice theme, which James picks up as well, he who loves money, or he who loves wealth. It is not money, it is not wealth. That is a root of evil. That's a better translation too as well. The love of money is, how does the rest of that go? Is a root of all evil. I'm sorry, yes, a root of all evil. But here indeed is a root of evil. The love of money, the love of wealth. One of my favorite movies, Top 25, Key Largo. If you've never seen that movie, you ought to pick it up, download it, Netflix, tonight. Edward G. Robinson plays Johnny Rocco. Humphrey Bogart, Frank McCloud, Lauren Bacall is in here as well. Great movie. But at one point, the Frank McCloud character, Humphrey Bogart, is speculating on what Johnny Rocco is all about. And he says, what Rocco wants is more. And the not too bright, the not too speculative Johnny Rocco lights up as if he's just had an aha moment. And he says, yeah, that's it, more. Yeah, see, that's what I want. That's what Johnny Rocco wants, more, more. Great scene. And this lust for more leads Rocco to manifold crime, of course, including murder. I'm convinced Solomon would nod his head in agreement if he were there to screen this movie with us. But Solomon also unfolds another dynamic of greed here, too. That is, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. What a nice turn of phrase. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. Funny how money buys friends, doesn't it? There's an old blues song. Nobody knows you when you're down and out. You know this song? Great blues song. Jimmy Cox, once again, sounds like the voice of experience, written during Prohibition. Once I lived the life of a millionaire, spent all my money, I just did not care. Took all my friends out for a good time, bought bootleg whiskey, champagne, and wine. Then I began to fall so low. Lost all my good friends. I did not have nowhere to go. I get my hands on a dollar again, I'm going to hang on to it till that eagle grins. Because nobody knows you when you're down and out. Ask for friends, you don't have any. When you finally get back on your feet again, everybody wants to be your old, long-lost friend. Said it's mighty strange, without a doubt. Nobody knows you when you're down and out. But there is further complexity as well. The more wealth one accumulates, the more managers he needs, our text communicates, the more managers he needs to preserve and, yea, increase it. The more wealth one accumulates, the greater one extends the borders of his estate. Remember, the idea of the estate, accumulating an estate, is one of the themes as well in Ecclesiastes, is it not? So keep that in mind as he treats of this here. The greater one extends the borders of his estate, the more barns, wells, bunkhouses, ranch hands, barbed wire, horses, tractors, cooks, maids, bookkeepers, lawyers, tax accountants, and crew chiefs a man needs, doesn't he? The more you get to eat, the more you find people eating it, right? When goods increase, they increase who eat them. Ask any small businessman. Koheleth would understand intuitively this little turn of phrase. The way to make a small fortune is to start out with a large one. And as he did in his previous set, Koheleth here provides a stark contrast, though. He says, but sweet is the sleep of the laborer, the one of modest means. Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Huh? Dear listener, are you tired of indigestion, ulcers, and the intestinal tract problems, huh? Solomon is so spot on here. If you've ever laid up awake at night or wrestled with your tummy at night because of money matters, Solomon is spot on here. Well, you could do one of two things, I would suggest. First of all, simplify. Simplify. We've been treating of that a little bit in our book study, haven't we? Simplify. Sounds so good, doesn't it, initially? Return to something of the simple lot of the laborer. That's one solution. This is the romantic and perhaps easier thing to do. I'm convinced it's not entirely biblical for all men, though. Not entirely biblical for all men, as Foster would inculcate with us. And I think it's absolutely naive when applied in a one-size-fits-all manner, the idea of simplifying. You can simplify in your circumstances, but you should always remain simplified in your hearts and your soul, too. So, simplify. One solution. The other solution, sanctify. Sanctify your labor. I use that so you could, for, as a mnemonic advice. Simplify or sanctify. That is, commit your ways to the Lord. Trust Him that you as a man will man up and become an entrepreneur and a manager, that God will give you the grace and the poise to be successful. To be successful and righteous. Develop a poised complexity. Some of us need to deal with complexity. Some of us need to become more complex and not simple. This is more difficult and less romantic. I'm convinced fewer men can do this, but it is a calling. And some of you must answer it. Become more complex, not simpler. Develop a poised sense in your complexity as your life becomes more complex, as your estate grows, if you will. Some of this is just naive to think that you can, all Christians should simplify as if we should somehow all be Thoreaus, you know, and go to Walden Pond and live in cabins. No. Some of you are called to be complex and live complex lives and be sanctified and poised in doing it. Well, Koheleth is not done dealing with this theme of riches either. These things come around in a cycle, don't they? He's dealt with riches in the past, he's dealing with them now, and he will deal with them in the future, yet in this book. But he'll take a different view of the gem, as he does, a different facet, if you will, of the gem each time. So in this gem of riches, he looks at another facet in verses 13 to 17. Dissatisfaction. A father not satisfied to generously bequeath his estate to heirs will turn to miserliness and selfishness. He will turn to miserliness and selfishness. Our reading of the law, we saw a little bit of Laban and Jacob, right? We saw a bit of Jacob's indignation at Laban. Laban should have been a poised, sanctified, gracious father-in-law to Jacob. Should he not have been? A poised, sanctified, gracious father-in-law. And generously bequeathed his entire estate to Jacob. Here he had a son in his arms, did he not? To whom he could have bequeathed an estate. Instead, he was selfish, miserly, and short-sighted. In fact, he tried to cheat Jacob, not only of his wages, which he changed 10 times, as Jacob indignantly pointed out, but his flocks and his wives, too. Laban will go on to say, the flocks are mine, the wife, your wives are mine, too. Laban becomes the figure lurking in the background of this section, if you will. All his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. You can see all those characteristics in Laban. This might even be the inscription on his tombstone, huh? Perhaps. Will it be on yours? He ate all his days in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. How'd you like to have that on your tombstone? Solomon here spins a parable, if you will, on the risks of venture capitalism, too. A man takes a portion of capital and invests it in a venture, a bad one, as it turns out. It may have well been a contemporary version. Here he goes again. It may well have been a contemporary version of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Perhaps he sunk it all into John Corzine's investment fund, huh? MF Capital. John Corzine, former New Jersey governor and senator, after he retired, he went back to Wall Street, developed MF Capital, and now, after it goes broke, $700 million of investor money is missing. Almost $1 billion. I don't know where it went. Testifying before Congress. Well, our imaginary investor turns out that he loses all that he had, has nothing then to bequeath to his heirs. Capitalism depends upon the investment of excess capital, that is, those monies as a remainder from operating expenses. And Koheleth qualifies the money invested in this bad venture as money kept to his hurt, he says, as money kept to his hurt. That is, money that should have been allocated in another fashion, but which, when disposed of in the manner indicated here, that is, in a bad venture, ends up destroying him. Without saying it outright, Koheleth indicates that this man is a fool. Tempted perhaps by greed or maybe failing to do due diligence, there's no excuse. You must do your due diligence in business or with your estate too. Those of you that have accumulated your estate, you are responsible for doing due diligence when you dispose of it. That is, investigating whether this was a sound investment, right? Those victims of Ponzi schemes. Bernie Madoff, for instance, asked Levi about Darren, right? How about those customers? Promised 20% return, 25% return, 33% return. That's almost too good to be true. In fact, it is too good to be true, isn't it? Do your due diligence, or it will destroy you. This man is a fool. Note the poignancy of his situation, too. He is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand, i.e. the son. He is father of a son, but the son has nothing in his hand. That is, the son is left without a reasonably expected inheritance. There's a contrast here with chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. Once again, he was there treating of wealth and bemoaning the man who has great wealth but no son. In contrast here, he has a son but now no wealth. The fleeting nature of riches, its utter vaporousness, underlined again in a segue from a newly begotten son. That's what that is literally. This man has a newly begotten son. I think the King James reflects that a little bit more clarity. This newly begotten son, he segues from that to the circumstances of his arrival. That is, as he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again. And there's an indication to both men here, both the father and the son. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, that is, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil, that he may carry it away in his hand. Babies don't come out supplied with a wardrobe and a month's supply of formula, do they? Thank goodness for mom. Likewise, there are no pockets and shrouds. There are no U-Hauls behind hearses, are there? Therefore, take your measure of your days. Be wise. Do not cling to riches. Do not be a Laban. But plan to end well. And if there is a remainder to your wealth, leave it soundly to your son. The sum of the matter, verses 18 to 20. Dissatisfaction. Do not be dissatisfied with your lot. Rather, a wise man is satisfied with his biblical lot. and finds satisfaction in his labor and the fruits of it. Heard this before, right? This has been around, it's coming around. Again, this theme, isn't that? Kohelet concludes, doesn't he? Concludes this section in what? How does he conclude? In despair. All is empty vanity. Perhaps all is utterly meaningless. He is not an existential philosopher, is he? Fie. Rather, he confesses that all is vapor, that is brief and fleeting. All is vaporous under the sun. A man's days are few that God has given him. But nowhere is despair counseled, nowhere is meaningless counseled to the reader. Solomon rather concludes that there are two worthwhile things to do while here under the sun, while we find ourselves pursuing the wind. Once again, that's not empty and vain, pursuing the wind that is brief and fleeting. Two things. Relish the sweetness of life while you can. Relish the sweetness of life while you can. These are further broken down under two headings. That is, enjoy your work and its fruits. Relish your work. I hope you have opportunity to do that. I hope you are positioned in a job where you can relish your work. Get some measure of enjoyment, satisfaction, self-worth, if you will, out of it. Some of us are better positioned than others. But I hope you don't have to hate to get up in the morning and go to your job. And that's all it is. Find a way to relish, to enjoy your work and its fruits too. Go home today. Maybe if your wife is as good a baker as mine, bake a loaf of fresh bread, open a bottle of red wine, enjoy it. Also, relish wisely the wealth you have accumulated. Relish wisely the wealth that you have accumulated. It's not evil. Not all men should simplify. Christians should responsibly use wealth too. There should be Christians out there that cultivate wealth and use it wisely. I haven't seen this done well often. More often than not, men are foolish or careless with wealth. And I hope that's not the case with you. This takes grace and poise developed over the length of a Christian life, dear listener. You must be much in the text, much at the side of other wise men too, and much on your knees in prayer. Seek out Christian men who know how to handle wealth and see how they can do it without eating in darkness and much vexation and sickness and anger. Have you read Silas Marner? I remember reading Silas Marner in high school. Silas Marner is a miser who hoards gold, and he doesn't like to spend. He eats in the darkness, literally eats in the dark because he doesn't want to waste money on candles. Can you imagine? Silas Marner, if you haven't read that in a while, George Eliot. He's also a Calvinist, so George Eliot is putting up so be aware of that as well. Become an entrepreneur, if you will, who can handle complexity and pressure. We need Christians not only who are simple, but we need Christians out there who are complex too and can handle pressure and do it with grace and with poise. Part of handling complexity and pressure with grace and poise is having a simplicity to the soul, too. That is a biblical simplicity, not a contrived simplicity like you find in some circles. And then learn to enjoy those fruits without being stingy, selfish, and greedy. Share with the needy. Give to the work of the gospel. But do not neglect relishing that which you have. I'm going to go practice what I preach pretty soon. I'm going to repair to the Friedels this evening. I've been looking forward to this all week. My son's home. Enjoy sweet fellowship with family. Imagine the Friedels and the Basses are almost family. Isn't that scary? So I'll go and repair to the Friedels, enjoy sweet fellowship with family, open a bottle of wine, enjoy some savory food, and put into practice what I'm preaching. But even in this, I am conscious by Kohelet's very use of the phrase under the sun that there is indeed one above the sun to whom I am responsible. And our text reminds us of this all through it, does it not? I will be accountable to him for these things. Our time in drawing near to the house of God reminded us of that last week, and it should you as well. It is, as Koheleth puts it, a gift of God, what we have, a gift of God. Our work, our labor, the fruits of our labor. How will I have used that gift given us? By His grace in Jesus Christ, may we hear our Lord's words on that day when we are held accountable. Well done, good and faithful servant. Huh? That parable of the talents captures it precisely. Now, those talents are not purely financial. They, indeed, all the gifts with which we are endowed, we are to use responsibly as unto God. But it does include our financial gifts as well. May we hear those words, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over little, I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. Let us now then come to that place where we find this relish of simple elements put